dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. And in that war, we find ourselves increasingly embroiled in a diplomatic, well, fandango, I guess is the best that one could call it. Snafu might be more accurate, or even more colorful terms. To help us make some sense of this, I am delighted to welcome back to our microphones a man we've spoken with in the past who knows something about diplomacy, and I imagine had his hands full dealing in the past, particularly when he was serving in Her Majesty's Foreign and Commonwealth Office as ambassadors to places like Sarajevo, Belgrade, and Poland, with some challenging diplomacy. He has written a very powerful article about a, well, very bad day in Western diplomatic history on the 9th of September. His name is Charles Crawford. Ambassador Crawford, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So you've written, as I say, recently a piece in the London Daily Telegraph entitled Syria, Chemical Weapons, and the Worst Day in Western Diplomatic History. That really is saying something. tell us why this qualifies.
Well, I think that there's different ways of measuring what is the worst day in diplomatic history. I suppose a lot of people would say Neville Chamberlain coming back from Berlin waving his piece of paper was pretty bad. I mean, it's an interesting question as what makes a bad diplomatic day. I think what struck me about what was going on last week was this sense of simply not having a plan. I mean, it's one thing having a plan made in good faith, like Neville Chamberlain or plenty of other examples you can think of, which for some reason or the other went wrong. What was striking about what went on last week was that it was just all over the place. You have a red line and it's not my red line. You have, Assad is a terrible guy. We've got to hit him, but don't worry, it'll be unbelievably small and all this sort of thing. It just seemed a complete muddle.
It does. And to the extent that in the midst of all of this, of course, on the September 9th, John Kerry sort of was musing out loud in a very public way, to be sure, but nonetheless musing about how this problem could possibly go away if Assad would turn over his chemical weapons right quick. Tell us about what happened from there and why, from the position of a professional diplomat, it has proved to be quite a hash-up.
Well, what happened from there was that the Russians seemingly pounced on this thought and proclaimed a willingness to say, OK, well, let's sort of solve this problem by doing just that. And then you've had a very intense and not in a way unimpressive attempt by the John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov to strike this deal, which a deal's been struck. And since, as part of all that, Syria has signed up for the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is, as these things go, not a bad outcome. The trouble with all this is that fundamentally, I think, it means that what we're really doing is legitimizing Assad, because what you'll have to do is have negotiations with him. And all of a sudden, the issue, if you look at the rhetoric, it's changed as well. The issue has gone away from Assad as a terrible man who's destroying Syria and somehow we need to create pluralism for Syria. It's all focusing on the very narrow, not unimportant, but nonetheless narrow question of him handing over his chemical weapons. And that means that, in a sense, he's now in control of a different sort of process. And as you can see, his people are saying this is a great victory for Syria. And it's hard on the face of it, if you define Syria as Assad, not to think they've got a point.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ambassador Charles Crawford, a retired diplomat from the United Kingdom. He is currently with the Ambassador Partnership, a firm involving diplomats like himself with considerable expertise trying to continue to contribute. And one of the things that I'm struck by in terms of where we find ourselves currently is John Kerry, I think just today, Mr. Besser, went forth and pronounced yet again, no, we're serious about helping the opposition, were serious about bringing about a transition from the Assad regime to something else. As a man who has had to work these kinds of problems, perhaps not quite on this sort of tightrope, but not chopped liver, as they say, either, in the midst of the crisis in the former Yugoslavia, can you have it both ways? Can you be actually saying we're going to work with the Assad regime to remove its chemical weapons and dispense with this terrible threat, and we're going to also dispense with the regime as well?
I think actually to a certain funny degree you can, because that's part of the game. I mean, they are going to cheat, and they also expect you to some degree to cheat. We had all this with Milosevic, of course, where, you know, Holbrooke negotiated with Milosevic, but I think he would have been quite keen for Milosevic to go, so we carried on talking to Milosevic, but we also brought in radio equipment and all sorts of other things to help the Serbian opposition, and Milosevic knew what we were doing and he didn't care. Now, Milosevic was in a rather stronger position than Assad is, because of, you know, obviously what's going on in Syria is much worse. So I don't think it matters too much if you say one thing and then do in parallel with that certain other things. What bothers me about Syria is not that so much. It's that it's just not clear what a sensible thing is to do to help the sensible opposition forces, because no one seems to quite be clear as to who they are.
Yeah.
And I think this is the strength ultimately of the Russian position, is that they are in a completely cynical and disgraceful way saying, look, Assad is terrible, but he is less terrible than anyone can identify. And there are people in our part of the world who might think that, loathsome though that is, they've got a point.
Yes, I'm struck by a turn of phrase that has been bruited about here recently, that in this case, the enemy of my enemy is my enemy. And it does raise the question as to whether it is advisable to be trying to help them come to power. And I'm struck by the fact that your own government has been a bit of a muddle about all this as well. Where do you think the United Kingdom lines up at the moment, Ambassador Crawford? Is it essentially out of the game? Is Cameron, the Prime Minister, having been told by Parliament not to proceed with a military attack, essentially sidelined, or is there still some role for the United Kingdom? And if so, what is it?
Well, there's several questions in that. I mean, I think the it's no point in threatening military action against something if you don't quite know what the positive result of that something is going to be. That was the weakness in, if you like, the American position. They were saying, yes, we're going to do something, but no one seemed to know what would be better if you did it. So I don't think that we're out of the game because we're no longer threatening action of that sort, because as far as I can see, it's not clear that America is seriously threatening action of this sort. Part of the drama of the whole situation is that now you're dealing with Assad. It makes it even more difficult as part of a diplomatic process to suddenly start bombing things. However, I mean, I think there is an interesting question that the things can change, because even if you end up in a bad outcome, it creates new dynamics. And I think one of the strange aspects of this is that all of a sudden, if the Russians are putting their weight upon some sort of process, it actually gets really embarrassing for them if Assad doesn't start delivering it in some sort of sizable quantities. So if it becomes clear that Assad is cheating and lying and hiding his chemical weapons and all this sort of stuff, then actually a Western strike might be much easier to justify to the public on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah. But as you indicated, Ambassador Crawford, and I think you're absolutely right, Assad is going to cheat. And the question is, in a way that is going to be detectable and actionable, if you will. And one of the things I'm struck by is that, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is having dealt with some wily tyrants and thugs in your time, does it in fact translate into a circumstance like the one you've just described, if he basically is saying, yes, I agree, I have exactly the amount of chemical weapons that you say I have, America, and the Russians have now affirmed, nothing more, and we actually have every reason to believe, I'm sure, that there is more there, not least perhaps Saddam Hussein's stocks. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure there's quite a lot there, and I'm sure he will declare some. And there's going to be a great game will now ensue. What I don't quite see is how, in the middle of the mayhem that's going on in Syria, it's going to be very easy for any international inspectors to go in there and check. I mean, I suppose in the great scheme of things, if in fact 80% of Assad's chemical weapons are somehow brought under control and neutralized, at least, not necessarily destroyed, but at least not available to him, you know, as things go, that's better than where we were before. But the price for that happening could be incredibly high. But I was reading something this morning saying that since all this happened, another 1,000 people have been killed in bombing exercises and beheadings and goodness knows what going on in Syria. So the you know, while we're sitting here patting ourselves on the back at this sort of diplomacy, not war, for the Syrian people and the 2 million refugees, the war may in fact be intensifying.
It may indeed. So Ambassador, we have to wrap with that. I appreciate so much your insights. Thank you very much, as always, for your clarity on these matters and for contributing to our thinking on it as well. Charles Crawford, former United Kingdom ambassador, and man we enjoy talking with when the opportunity presents itself. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Matthew Continetti joins us from the Washington Free Beacon. We'll get his take on America withdrawing from the world. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by the splendid editor-in-chief of a relatively new but remarkable resource, the Washington Free Beacon. He is Matthew Cotinetti. Despite a staggeringly young age, he has made quite a mark in Washington, including in the past as the opinion editor of the Weekly Standard. He is the author of several books, including The K Street Gang, and The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Media, Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. Matthew Cotinetti, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You have recently unburdened yourself of what I thought was just a terrific essay in the Free Beacon. It's your column entitled, The Long Withdrawing War. It's Putin's world now. America is just living in it. Wow. Talk to us a little bit about how you draw this rather stark and dismal prospect.
Well, I think that the so-called deal regarding serious chemical weaponry struck between Secretary of State Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, was the latest evidence in a long chain of evidence showing how America is in retreat in the greater Middle East, and Russia, really, is replacing it, replacing our power with its own. And this is disturbing to me because, and it's, you know, despite the fact that our shale energy revolution here in North America is making us more independent of oil resources in the Middle East, it's still a vital area. I mean, you know, when you look at something like the Suez Canal, for example, the Straits of Hormuz, it's a major shipping area. Of course, our ally Israel is right in the middle of this. It's important that America be involved in the Middle East, and under this president, we're in retreat, and I think it makes us less safe.
We're talking with Matt Cotinetti, editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, about what it might mean for all of us if America does indeed withdraw, not just from the Middle East, but from the wider world. And Matt, if the United States is in fact in retreat from the Middle East and arguably more broadly, and Matt, you were just sort of working up to what kind of dangers and stakes are involved here. Do you really regard this as something that will represent an imminent and material threat to the United States, to its people here at home?
Well, certainly the issue of nuclear proliferation, Frank, it presents a threat to the American homeland. I mean, let's not forget, in the midst of this withdrawal from the region, Iran is continuing on its nuclear program. And I believe that Iran is pursuing nuclear energy in order to obtain nuclear weaponry, despite what the National Intelligence Estimate might say. And so there's no question in my mind that if Iran reaches nuclear capability, then you'll see proliferation throughout the region unless America, you know, is involved and is strong. And so wider proliferation means both wider probability of the use of nuclear weapons and also wider probability of them falling into the wrong hands, I think.
You have in your column of last week in the Washington Free Beacon, Matt Cotinetti, a marvelous paragraph, and I won't read the entirety of it, but it really synthesizes what I think concerns me most and it vexes me particularly in terms of the absence of a loyal opposition. You start off by saying, quote, "For several years now, Americans have been comfortable in the delusion that the benefits such as they are of a global economy and of a world where war is a rarity can be enjoyed without cost," unquote. Develop that thought a little bit in terms, again, of what it might mean, again, perhaps not tomorrow, but in the predictable future, to each of us, if we persist in slashing defense spending, gutting the Navy, pulling out of theaters of combat and strategic bases, and the other things that you warn against.
Sure. Well, I compared in an essay on the Free Beacon America's receding power to a receding tide. And when the tide recedes, it's a mistake to think that there's just nothing left when things appear in the wake with seaweed or sand crabs, they come on the shore. And just as American power recedes, it will be replaced by others who do not share interests, and that's such as Russia or Iran or the Taliban, who are organizing to replace us once we leave Afghanistan next year. And those influences, the more powerful they become, the more likely conflict becomes, and then the greater the chances that that conflict will reach our shores or create a situation, as we've seen throughout America history, where the conflict becomes so great overseas that America just can't ignore it and has to intervene.
Indeed. Under almost certainly worse circumstances and with less capability to do so. We were speaking in the previous segment, Matt Continetti, with Ambassador Charles Crawford of the United Kingdom, who unburdened himself of a similar kind of cri de coeur, shall we say, that had as its headline the worst day in Western diplomatic history, talking about the latest Syria debacle. You have a very powerful sentence in your essay in which you say, quote, "What I cannot stomach is the humiliation of my country on the world stage," unquote. Talk a little bit about that and the prospect, as you say, that Russia in particular is part of the flotsam and jetsam, if I can stick with your analogy, that is turning up in the vacuum that we're creating, the receding tide.
Well, I think there's no question that we've been humiliated. I mean, it's not only the whipsaw foreign policy with regard to Syria that we've seen in recent weeks. Remember, just, 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of State was comparing Assad to Hitler, saying that this was our Munich moment, and now we're negotiating with Russia in order to secure the chemical weaponry. Even if this deal were a success, it would have mean Assad paid no price. This Hitler figure has paid no price. That in itself, I think, is humiliating because it shows to the world just how unserious this foreign policy is. And I'm less concerned with what it tells our enemies, who are going to go about their bad business anyway, than what it tells our friends. And I think if you're the government in Japan, if you're the government in Australia, if you're the government in Israel, if you're the government in Poland, if you're the government in Jordan, the government of Saudi Arabia, historic American allies, you're looking at this and saying, we need to begin making contingencies about what to do in this, in a world where America is weak, and negotiating with Russia, which I might add, why are we negotiating with Russia? Yeah, okay, they have a military base there. They're a defeated power. And it's the very idea that we've treated Russia as somehow our equal in international affairs that has led us to a place where the Russian dictator lectures us in our most influential newspaper on the fact that, according to him, American exceptionalism does not exist. That is a humiliation.
We are dealing with Russia, of course, not as a defeated power, but as a rising power. And let me just, in the closing minute we have with you, Matt Continetti, ask about something you alluded to a moment ago. Egypt is another of those countries that we've historically been aligned with. It runs the Suez Canal. What are the implications, if they take away from all of this, the idea that it's better to be lashed up with the Russians again, not us?
Right. Well, I think General Sisi has kind of already ridden off America. And I've seen reports just in recent weeks that there might be a recommendation to Obama to cut off military aid to the generals there, which would make him run and look elsewhere, whether it be Saudi Arabia, which is already providing aid to the Egyptian government, or even Russia. Again, it's just lack of seriousness and also the sense of just being kind of floating on the waves of international affairs that I think has led all of the allied governments to begin just writing America off. And I fear that will make for a more dangerous situation until we have a new president, which won't be for another 3 years.
Yeah, a long time. Matt Continetti, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for the terrific work you do at the Washington Free Beacon. You and your team are a big part of our program here at Secure Freedom Radio. We appreciate it greatly. We'll look forward to a further visit in the near future. Next up, Harold Rowe joins us on the search for those elusive moderates in Syria. Are they there? Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, Russia and the United States agreed on a plan to place Syria's chemical arsenal under international control. Unfortunately, it can't work. Never mind the inherent problems with moving, let alone dismantling these deadly weapons. Ignore the difficulties of finding trained personnel willing on short notice to do such dangerous work, particularly in the middle of a war zone. One factor alone is sufficient to doom this cockamamie plan. We don't know the actual size or whereabouts of Bashar Assad's chemical arsenal. There's increasing evidence that he's moving and hiding what he can, and now that we have told the Russians what we think is there, you can bet Assad will keep whatever has eluded us. Syria's chemical genie is not going back into the bottle. Expecting otherwise is delusional. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Harold Rode. He is currently with the Gatestone Institute, where he is a senior fellow, but he is one of the country's true experts on the Middle East, having served as kind of the duty authority on the region for successive administrations and secretaries of defense in the office of the Secretary of Defense. In that connection, I had the privilege of working with him there a long time ago, and it's always a pleasure to have a chance to visit with him, especially as matters in the region are in such ferment. Harold Rode, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Frank, very nice to be back, and it was a pleasure working with you as well at the Pentagon.
Thank you. Let us talk first and foremost about Syria, Harold. I'm interested in your take as a guy, again, with deep knowledge of the subject, about the claims that are being made by, among others, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, that there are moderates with whom we can very productively work in the Syrian opposition to bring about a post-Assad regime that will be, if not a Jeffersonian democracy, at least one where freedom, including that of minorities, is respected, and we don't simply find ourselves confronting another Islamist, if not Al-Qaeda, bastion in a very strategic part of the world.
Well, I know 2 years ago we could have easily found forces like that, just like in Anbar. There are local Muslim Sunni leaders who had notables that simply since then Al-Qaeda and groups like Al-Qaeda had come in and basically taken over. They have their own courts. They administer the most awful Sharia justice. And there's no doubt that I think 2 years ago we could have done it. Today, and given Americans' real understanding of the American government's really understanding of what's going on inside of Syria, which is, I think, very, very limited, I don't see how we could do it. There's no doubt these elements exist, but I have a way that we could get to them eventually, and certainly not now. And here's what it is. Sure, we have to take care of Assad and the guys using chemical weapons. It was supposedly, this was a red line. I say supposedly because we didn't care in Halabja when Saddam used chemical weapons against the Kurdish villages. We basically looked the other way. And for that matter, our government did almost nothing when in World War II when the Nazis were using gas to murder all sorts of people in the concentration camps. So I'm not really sure where we go with that. But here's the problem. Assad has killed a lot of people, and who knows what the numbers are. We can't really know what's true and wrong. We have absolutely no way of knowing that. And if it is decided that we are going to go after his nuclear, chemical, biological weapons and take them out, I would take out also his Air Force, because that's the group of people, that is the force that is really reaping havoc on all the civilians. But at the same time, we must do something else. If we're going to do that, we must go after the Sunni fundamentalists, and that is Jabhat al-Nusra. This is the Al-Qaeda-related people, people that the Saudis are funding, people that the Turks are funding, people that the Qataris are funding. These are our so-called allies, and we don't want to do that. But if we take out Assad alone or his abilities, we are in essence helping the fundamentalists. And unfortunately, it is the fundamentalist Sunnis that are running most of the Sunni communities right now. Yes, there is this FSA, I think it's the Free Syrian Army. I'm not sure exactly what it stands for. These may be, I would say, relative good guys, but they don't have the edge right now. It is the bad guys among the Sunnis. So if we go and do something against Assad and don't do anything against the Sunni fundamentalists, it is these people who are going to take over. No,
right. And that's not in our interest. Let me just reintroduce our guest is Harold Rode. He is currently a senior fellow with a wonderful organization, the Gatestone Institute, and a very knowledgeable and quite highly regarded expert on matters involving the Middle East. And Harold, forgive me for cutting you off, but I do want to switch over to another topic that you just alluded to, and that is the support that the Turkish government is providing to, at best, the Muslim Brotherhood, and at worst, Al-Qaeda,
yes,
among these Islamist factions. Tell us what's going on inside Turkey at the moment, Harold, and the advisability of continuing to regard this regime of Recep Tayyip Erdogan as an ally of the United States in the Syria context and more broadly.
I think you used the right word there when you called it a regime. A regime is invariably used for dictators, and that's, in fact, what Erdogan has become. Since he has been made to look like a fool and weak all over the Middle East, he has this policy, they call it, with no problems with any neighbor. In fact, they have problems with every neighbor as a result of their marvelous insights and their supposed knowledge of their neighbors, which they don't really have. That's one. But as he's being made to look like a fool in Turkey, which is the worst thing that can happen in the Middle East, it's worse than death that people shame you. What he is now doing is, besides going after the military people whom he despises, he's now going after civilians who oppose him. And there are now going to be arrests of all sorts of people. This is what he basically has said. There are going to be arrests. People are going to be brought in for questioning. This is not a democracy anymore.
Right.
And why we would see Erdogan as an ally is beyond me. Turkey is a different story in the future. We will see. If Turkey can go back to its Atatürkist past, which was that the government would be secular, that democracy, that the people, what the people say would be what happens, that could be an ally. It was an ally of the United States.
A strategically critical ally, as a matter of fact. But Harold Rode, how do we get there from here? He has arrested the senior leadership of the military, which, as you know, historically was the guardian of that Atatürk legacy. Are elections a vehicle for this, given what he's done to undermine, as you say, the democratic processes in his country?
And institutions.
The problem with elections everywhere is elections are icing on the cake. It's not the cake. The cake is the democratic foundations of a society. You only put on the icing on a cake when you have the cake made already,
right,
when it's been cooked.
So what do we do?
In this particular instance, the cake has been destroyed. And so elections in a situation like this, where he has arrested or silenced so many people who disagree with him, won't really change matters.
Right.
Because
what hope is there of the kind of change that you're talking about that's clearly, I think, in our interest and the interest of both the Turks and the wider region?
Frankly, there's only one way to handle this. America has to assume its natural role, whether it likes it or not, of policeman of the world. It basically keeps things in line. And when people step out of line, we make sure to keep them in line. When America sneezes, the world catches a cold, and in this particular, maybe even pneumonia. And what is happening right now with the weakness of our president, that he is feigning to the world, and his incompetence, is that people are laughing at us. They are basically saying, whatever America says, it doesn't matter. We're going to do what we want.
Yeah. As we were talking about with Matt Continetti, Harold Rode, a moment ago, it makes for a much more dangerous world. Listen, let me conclude quickly, if I may, a minute left, about Iran. You follow this very closely. The president is apparently exchanging correspondence now with the new president of Iran, Rouhani. Is there any possibility good can come of that?
I think zero. All he is a nice face for an awful regime. When I say nice face, this man was involved in Iran's bombing in Argentina, where they blew up, I think it was a Jewish center, I don't remember exactly what it was, some years ago. But that's, of course, all hidden now. It's forgotten about. It's as if you rehabilitated, not Hitler, that's a bit extreme, but that sort of thing, some senior Nazi. This guy is a bad guy, and he is window dressing to the world by talking moderate, by using Twitter or whatever he's using. This is a bad man. They are playing America for a song, and we are going along. And as a result of us, again, being weak and showing weakness, the danger which this could produce in the world, or at least the area that we're talking about in the Middle East, is huge.
It is indeed.
Absolutely huge.
It is indeed. Harold Rode, you will be following it closely, and I hope you'll be continuing to keep us apprised of it. We've got to go. Thank you very much for joining us. The great work you do at the Gatestone Institute. Keep it up. Next up, we'll be talking about Gordon Chang. We'll get his take on what the Chinese are up to in the meantime, as we are distracted. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting, as we do about this time each week, with our friend Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert on matters involving Asia and that of many others, including Forbes.com, where he writes a weekly column, also World Affairs Journal, Fox News, and many other outlets that turn to him for counsel and his sage advice. As do we. Welcome back, Gordon. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You have written about something that has not gotten a whole lot of attention in the course of this Syrian crisis, namely the presence. I don't know if it's unprecedented, but it certainly, I think, is in a moment like this of high drama and possible military action to have naval vessels of the People's Liberation Army in the eastern Mediterranean, in not too distant quarters with the United States flotilla in the region, as well as the Russian Navy's presence there. Tell us, Gordon, as you see it, how the Chinese are viewing this, why they've got ships there, and what implications it may have for any possible strike plan that the United States might ultimately decide is necessary against Bashar Assad, their client, in Syria.
Frank, this is unprecedented. We have Chinese ships in the eastern Mediterranean, and Beijing officially says that they're to observe American and Russian vessels there. But I think that that doesn't make sense. And the Chinese can find out what they want to know through other means. I think they're actually there basically to help the Russians. And that's important because the United States now is there with NATO fleets, French and Italian, but it's opposed by Russian and Chinese ships. And so this could be extremely dangerous as we look going forward. And this could very well have played a part of the calculations in the White House not to strike Syria.
Yeah, I have the feeling you're right, Gordon. To the extent that the Chinese ships are there, tell us, if you can, what their order of battle is at the moment and what kind of capabilities they might have to mix it up with the U.S. fleet, if any.
Well, they have their coolest-looking ship in the eastern Mediterranean right now, which is this Jingguanshan. It's a 689-foot ship. It is what the Chinese use when they want to intimidate others. So, for instance, they used it in the South China Sea earlier this year to basically scare off the countries around China's periphery. This is a landing dock ship. It can carry about 1,000 Chinese Marines, essentially a battalion, and it is there with support ships. So this is important because what the Chinese are trying to do is to send a message to Washington with its ships. Now, at the end of the day, there are not enough ships there to make a difference. I mean, we still have our submarines. We still have our fleets. We have the Nimitz strike group not too far away in the Red Sea. But nonetheless, this is a warning. And the Obama administration, which may lack resolve, this could really have tipped the balance.
And at the very least, Gordon, it creates a tripwire for any adventure that the United States might engage in, that it may well precipitate a bigger problem with China, even if it doesn't necessarily alter our ability to project power against Syria in the immediate term. This is obviously a problem that we will be following closely, as I know you will as well, Gordon, and I hope you'll keep us abreast of your thinking on it. Let me ask you about something that we talked about with one of our colleagues, and I know a good friend of yours, Dr. Bruce Bechtel, last week, speaking of Syria and Asia and its implications for this particular crisis. North Korea, he reminds us, has been, of course, very actively involved in Syria for quite some time, apparently including in helping it acquire and store and train with chemical weapons. Bruce also mentioned that that North Koreans, with their capacity for tunneling, may also have been active in helping the Syrians hide whatever chemical weapons they don't want us to know about. What are your thoughts on that? Is Bruce likely to be right?
Oh, Bruce is definitely right. You know, as he points out, the North Koreans have sold at least complete chemical factories to the North Koreans. We know from other sources that the North Koreans are providing after-sales services, which includes helping the Syrians fabricate warheads and also to synthesize chemicals. And incredibly, North Korean military officers have been spotted in the front lines of the civil war, presumably directing the use of chemical weapons. So, for instance, the North Koreans were spotted near Aleppo, and that's important because that was near one of the first uses of chemical weapons this year. So the North Korean involvement with the Syrian chemical weapons program has been continuous, ongoing, as well as the North Korean involvement in Syria's reactor in the desert, which the Israelis destroyed in September 2007. That was sold by the North Koreans to the Syrians. The Iranians actually paid for it. And we believe that North Korean technicians died in that raid. So these connections between Syria and North Korea, as Bruce points out, have really been very troubling, and we have not been dealing with the issue.
Yeah, a real axis of evil, in other words, and one that may have bearing on the feasibility of any deal to remove these chemical weapons from Syria, if in fact that plan of John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov goes forward. Gordon Chang is our guest. He is, among other things, the author of two important books, speaking of North Korea, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and also The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon, lastly, one thing that you and I have been discussing for some time is the clear Chinese ambition to have the U.S. dollar replaced as the world reserve currency by the yuan. And what has seemingly provided some consolation with respect to this very worrying prospect is that the Chinese yuan is not convertible. And yet you write in your Forbes piece this week that that may be no longer true in just a few months' time. Talk to us about that and the implications of it.
At the end of this month, the Chinese are going to officially open their Shanghai Free Trade Zone. And everyone has been saying that as a part of this free trade zone, financial institutions will be able to freely convert the Chinese renminbi, the currency, on the capital account. The currency is convertible on the current account. That's since December 1996. But it has not been convertible on the capital account, which means you can't take your investments out of China. You can't bring money into China without permission. Now, because of what's going to happen in the zone, and because the Chinese have a genius for ignoring Beijing's particular rules, I think that essentially the Chinese currency will become convertible on the capital account as a practical matter because there's going to be a widespread violation of restrictions. And this is important because the only thing that is really standing behind the general use of the renminbi around the world is its non-convertibility on the capital account. Well, if as a practical matter it does become convertible, that means the Chinese currency is going to make great strides.
And what are the implications for the United States economy, as well as for our position around the world, if the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, supplanted, at least in part, by the Chinese renminbi?
This really would be a disaster because the United States has a lot of leverage over the global economy because our currency is considered to be the world's reserve currency. Central banks around the world keep a majority of their reserves in dollars. So this is an important tool that we have to try to maintain some order in the world. Now, if the renminbi becomes the world's reserve currency, the problem is that the Chinese don't act for the benefit of the international community. They often act in their own peculiar, very narrow, and extremely selfish benefit. And this is going to be a problem. This is going to cause chaos around the world eventually.
Yeah.
So we've got to make sure that we defend the dollar.
We do indeed. And I hope that that's the priority of the next Federal Reserve Chairman and the Treasury Secretary, and for that matter, the Obama administration. Not clear that it is on their radar scope. Gordon, will be following it closely, not least because we mark today, I believe, the fifth anniversary of the takedown of Lehman Brothers, which is an indication, as our friend Kevin Freeman points out, of the distinct possibility that economic warfare against this country, perhaps through currency plays like this, can be devastating, and particularly so if we're not the reserve currency. Gordon Chang, as always, thank you for joining us. Good to talk with you. We'll do so again next week, and we'll hope to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney.
Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.